Good morning, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, coming right up. And this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Back to Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back to Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at 503-233-1929. And we got the, as I said, the Old Moles are coming, are waiting in the wings to bring you their show at, let's see what else we got going on today. At 10 o'clock, Eduardo de Landeros Thierry speaks, hosts a special Health Watch and Earth Watch program with a focus on the increasing number of people with asthma. And don't forget that at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now, as usual.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I'd mole in the ground.
They say the left wants to destroy Christmas. No, we just want to survive it. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7, listener-supported community radio. It's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris. Yes, Christmas came and Christmas went, and the empire seems to have remained intact. So while Christians may be losing the culture wars, they still have their holiday. And this morning we will look at the origins of this holiday called Christmas. Tom Becker will dig through the dark side to reveal the lesser-known traditions. And I'm not talking about red-nosed reindeers. Mole from Another Planet, Norm Diamond, will lead us back to 1997. That year, 45 people attending a prayer meeting of Roman Catholic activists for indigenous rights were massacred in a small village in Acteal in Chiapas, Mexico. Through music and commentary, Norm will help us remember and understand this important event. Well, last week, New York City transit workers put the city back on its feet when it went out on strike. I mean that literally. Millions of people walking the streets of New York. I would have loved to have seen it on just a normal day, but on a day like that, how incredible. So I would have loved to have been there, but I couldn't. But Bill Resnick, our mole, he just happened to be there. Well, he didn't just happen to be there. He went there to visit family, like many others, I'm sure, and he found himself in the middle of a great political struggle. We have Bill on the line right now talking with Steve Downs. Steve is a subway conductor and a radical within a labor movement. Very exciting. We have both of them on the line on phones, so we'll hope we get a good connection with them. And Bill, how are you doing out there?
Really good, Denise. Thanks a lot. And Downs, welcome to KBOO. Is Steve there? Hi, how are we doing in the air room?
It doesn't appear that we've got Steve. We'll have to try again. So we will try to take a bit of an interlude here and try to get back with them in just a second. Bill, you on the line, why don't you, if you would, say a little about what it was like and what the kind of tone of just folks in the city was. We've heard a lot of conflicting feedback, of course, depending on who you listen to out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the newspapers here and everywhere were the amazing resilience of New York City people, blah. In fact, they were, of course, a lot of people were walking. It made the city actually in some ways nicer. But the transit strike was 100% effective. New York, it shut down.
Our external factors. Our biggest factors are that the enormous pent-up anger and frustration on the part of the membership. And they, for some time, have wanted the opportunity to just sort of stand up to say, we're here, you have to take us seriously, this is what we can do. And we didn't strike in 3 years ago in 2002, which was Rogers' first time negotiating a contract. Many people feel that we didn't get as good a deal as we could have. This year, I think there was less of an expectation that there would be a strike, but the transit authority and the governor's arrogance and insistence at the last minute that we had to give up some wages for people who weren't on the job yet, was a position that Roger had made clear all along he was unwilling to take, that the union would never accept, and the fact that they kept insisting on that and driving it home just made it impossible for us to bear any longer, and the strike was called.
Mm-hmm. There have been a few sort of hints in the newspaper that a kind of deal was made that workers would get, you know, kind of a cost, a reasonable pay raise, sort of keeping up with inflation, maybe not, but close, of about 3% or whatever it is, 4% a year, but would have to give some on health benefits. Is that what it looks like?
I've seen the same reports in the press, so when the mediator spoke, state-appointed mediator spoke on Thursday to say that the union had agreed with his proposal to return its membership to work and resume negotiations, he explicitly said that they reckoned that the give-back in pensions was something that was impossible for the unions to accept, but that the union had agreed to help the authority find cost savings in other areas, particularly in the areas of health benefits. So, yeah, my issue is that deal that's going to include members paying premiums for health benefits, which we pay co-payments when we use the service, but we don't pay premiums out of our checks on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. I was in New York. I'm still here, actually, during the strike. The newspapers were full of all this stuff, as I explained earlier to the audience when you weren't on. Newspapers were full of all this resiliency of New York and how heroic and wonderful we all are and can adjust. But in fact, you basically, the transit workers are absolutely central to the operation of the city. It can't work. It doesn't work. Everything is, all of its major industries are crippled. And yet it seems that, that you guys, first your pay is lousy for New York City, and like a lot of public workers, and secondly, they haven't even made allowances for you to go to the bathroom during your shift. I mean, in some ways, it's, they don't have places for you there. I mean, it's striking the difference between your immense power, it seems to me, that few labor unions in the world have. I mean, to be able to basically shut down, it's like a general strike all on your own, but it shows what a real general strike could be like. It's a tremendous power. And the very minimal, it seems to me, I mean, your salaries aren't terrible, but it's there's something striking about the contrast. That was the outcome.
I think that the... I certainly agree with you. I think that it's important to our bosses, to the MTA, to the governor and the mayor, and to the industries that back them, that we sort of not have a sense of our own power. And which is one of the reasons why the TALOG exists, which it prohibits strikes by public employees. It was a direct result of a 1966 transit strike. And it provides for enormous fines on public employees when they do strike. So that has affected...
Not just the executives, but the whole union, right? Everybody who stays out.
Yes, yes. The union
itself is fined. I mean, you're
facing
a big fine right
now. Individual member. I'm sorry?
You're facing a big fine right now, potentially.
Yeah, each individual member is fined, and the union as an institution is fined. I mean, probably if the fines hold, our treasury is going to be wiped out just by a 3-day strike.
Mm-hmm.
As well as each individual member paying fines. So that law has pretty effectively cowed most unions in the state. So they haven't tried to use their power. And as a result, they've accepted deteriorating working conditions, loss of benefits, wages that aren't keeping up with inflation, precisely because the the cost of fighting for that, for defending those the decent wages and benefits, or improving them and getting better working conditions, the cost of going to the going on strike to defend that stuff is so enormous that very few unions are willing to take that chance.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, talking to Steve Downs, who's been an executive board member of the Transit Workers Union of New York for 10 years, writes on labor issues, and was a major player in the dissident movement that that finally took over the union, good Roger Toussaint as the president. Steve, what I was sort of surprised by what I thought was pretty mild kind of rhetoric and argumentation by Toussaint on the class issues. And after Mayor Bloomberg said, you know, that you workers are selfish and thuggish, and that you're somehow hurting the really poor people of New York, he did go after the thuggish one, arguing that that was coded racism. But he was very muted in on the class question. Who really is depleting the lives of poor people? Is it millionaires and billionaires like Bloomberg, or is it the work from the people who are topping out at $55,000 a year in New York City? Not much of a wage. But he didn't do it really strongly. What would you do you see the possibility of really raising the issues more strongly? And what do you make of that?
Well, first I just want to point out, because your listeners might not be aware of it, support among the working people in the city for the strike was quite high. So precisely the people that Bloomberg was saying were being hurt the most saw that they took sides. They saw they had an interest in the union winning this fight, because they saw that somebody was finally drawing a line on wages and benefits and conditions. I was picketing the whole time in Bedford Park in the Bronx, which is a pretty diverse working class neighborhood, and overwhelmingly people who pass by on the street would say a few words of encouragement, would complain about having to walk, but with you guys. There were, you know, people would give us money to buy coffee, or would go buy coffee and drop it off themselves. So, and even a survey to TV stations in town on the second day of the strike, 52% of New Yorkers supported the union, while roughly 40% supported the MTA. But I think that's important for people to know and to keep in mind. I think there is a potential, given that sort of thing, there is certainly a potential to make class more of an issue fight, to draw the line much more clearly between workers and bosses. I think, and this is just my opinion, I haven't imparted any strategy discussions on this issue, but partly the union was limited in doing that because of the political strategy it pursues year-round, not just at contract, which is one of trying to make a firm alliance with the Democratic Party in New York City, and it's relying on city councilmen, state assemblymen, to conduct investigations, to give the union a pulpit from which to present its case. And there's only so far they can go in making this a class issue, given that choice of who they want their political allies to be.
Mm-hmm. Denise and Tammy, this is Bill. I can hear you talking. It's really it's sort of distracting. I don't know if Steve hears you talk as well. Is there some way that we can talk to one another without all the air room noise coming in? Again, this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Steve Downs, a subway operator in New York. He also writes on labor issues, and he's was for 10 years a member of the executive board of the Transit Workers Union as a part of the dissident. Steve, if let's say that they hadn't made all of these choices to work with the Democratic Party and to not be offensive, it seems to me it was a tremendous opportunity to make a sort of a to take the fight to the people who are really injuring the poor and working people, particularly in New York City, and with Bloomberg, a multi-billionaire, part of a party, a member of a party who's giving enormous tax breaks to the richest of the rich, it would have been possible to say something. If you were doing the press for the TWU and helping Toussaint with his speeches, what sort of, it seems to me we really should have to develop a stronger class position to reach out to working people. Although, as you pointed out, people still have supported the transit workers.
Right. Well, I guess I would have emphasized much more the, on one hand, the national policies that you just mentioned, so that the tax breaks for the wealthy. It's also the case that over the last couple of administrations, not just under the Republicans, but under Clinton as well, subsidies to mass transit have been drastically cut as taxes in general have been cut. I think that the you also should highlight the policies of the past several city administrations, which have given enormous tax breaks to banks and other corporations who threaten to leave and take jobs with them. And somehow when they threaten to leave and disrupt the economy, money is thrown at them. When we disrupt the economy to be able to stay in the city, to be able to afford the city and buy a house and contribute in that way to the city, we're thugs and terrorists, and we're hit by fines. So I think that, highlighting that kind of contrast and also talking about alternative policies that could be pursued by state and local government who were intent on providing decent services and decent jobs. I think that certainly if the I think that sort of thing has to be thought of and prepared in advance and become a part of our union, other unions' arsenal as we go into these kinds of fights.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me working people sort of recognize that. You pointed out earlier that when you were picketing, and polls showed that the great majority of New York's working people were sort of supportive and recognized what was really at stake in the strom. In fact, even the police, it seems to me, you told me earlier, why don't you tell us about the... I mean, it seems to me there really is a lot of hope and the sort of the ideological blinders are beginning to fall and people are beginning to recognize what's happening. I guess the police is one area.
Yeah, it was kind of strange being on the picket line. I've never witnessed something like this. There were police stationed at every place where there were pickets, but they were very friendly, did not try to hassle the pickets or limit what we could do. It's not like there were significant numbers of people trying to cross lines, so you didn't have those kinds of confrontations. But the police had recently, they went 2 years without a contract, and it was recently settled this fall through binding arbitration. And in that process, the police were forced an enormous pay cut for new hires, for officers. And I think that the officers knew they got a raw deal. They knew that they weren't treated well by both either the city or by the binding arbitration process. So, in fact, the police union here, as well as the detectives union, sponsored coffee wagons, which went to the picket sites, providing coffee and donuts to the pickets. The president of the union, Lynch is his last name. I can't remember his first name offhand. Drove one of the trucks on one day to make a point. He was asked by the press, you're police officers, these people are breaking the law, how can you be so supportive of them? And he was very clear that he understood that the assault that was taking place on us was going, they would be confronted with it if it wasn't stopped by us. So it was going to be an issue for them in their negotiations. They had just had to take a hit on starting salary for new hires. They were bound to have to face up to demands on their pensions and on their health benefits as well. So he saw that it was in his members' interest that our union be successful in getting a good contract. Mm-hmm. And his father was also a transit worker, so he has a sort of a personal solidarity with transit workers as well.
One last issue, Steve, where I think our time is coming to an end, but police are sort of in a odd position in their this society, and it really conservatizes them. Most cops see themselves as conservative, live in conservative communities, you know, many of them not can afford to live in the city, so they commute forever to these, you know, highly actually homogeneous police communities in Rockland County and around New York City where there's a lot of cops. But yet they sort of maintain this because they're struggling and fighting with poor people. They become real law and order, of course. They develop this in this anger at the kind of and at the poor, and it drives conservative positions. Do you think they're beginning to recognize that? And it's true of a lot of working people, actually, that to get a much larger of what's happening. You know, they're very patriotic to the America that they love. That in fact, and getting even a sense, especially through the transit workers, that it's workers who are in fact operating our cities and making the trains run, and that the management of the TDU is so duplicitous actually, and is in so low little regard, but that in fact all of capital now has really shown themselves their predatoriness. Is that coming through? What's your sense?
That's more of a reach than I would want to make. I think it's too early to tell on that. I'm certainly with in this. You know, it was a short strike. It was 3 days. It's hard to know what would have happened if it had gone on longer. If conflict had escalated, it would have been nice if some of the other unions had stepped up and said, if you break the TWU or you throw rail, then we're walking off the job, or had organized some support demonstrations. None of that happened. So the lines weren't as clear as they might have been. For the average police officer, and that's why I don't want to, I'm in no position to judge the state of their consciousness. I think that from the few I've spoken with, there's a union consciousness more than there is a class consciousness. So they're members of the PBA. They just went through a particularly rough contract fight. They identified with our contract fight, but it was more because we're both city workers, members of city unions, similar, and some come out of sort of the same communities. When you look at the African American or Latino officers, they come out of the same communities as many of the transit workers come from. So,
Steve Downs, thanks a lot for talking to us. Keep up the struggle in New York City.
Okay, thanks, Bill. My pleasure.
Right, so long.
Bye.
You are listening to KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. It's Monday morning. It's the day after Christmas, and we're feeling festively excited about moving on to the new year. Aren't we? All right. We got a little cheer out of Tammy Dean, our engineer, this morning. Thanks to Bill and Steve calling from New York to talk about the transit strike. Very well-timed, and hopefully will be a successful move for the union and for others as well struggling in labor. Next up we have Tom Becker. He has a little piece called A Puritan Christmas. He'll take us through the dark side.
Every year during the holiday season, we hear the constant lament that Christmas has become overly secularized and commercialized, and look back nostalgically on days of yore, when Christmas was a time of religious worship and tranquility, a time in the current West for a celebration of traditional family values. So today I'm going to share with you what Christmas was like in the days of our Puritan forefathers and mothers. I will be mainly quoting from a book entitled The Battle for Christmas, A Cultural History of America's Most Cherished Holiday, by Stephen Nissenbaum. In New England, Nissenbaum writes, for the first two centuries of white settlement, most people did not celebrate Christmas. In fact, the holiday was systematically suppressed by Puritans during the colonial period and largely ignored by their descendants. It was actually illegal to celebrate Christmas in Massachusetts between 1659 and 1681. The fine was 5 shillings. Around 1850, only around 1850 did Christmas gain legal recognition in New England. Prior to then, children went to school on Christmas, the courts were in session, markets were open, and churches were closed unless December 25th happened to fall on a Sunday. As late as 1952, one person could recall being told by his grandparents that New England mill workers risked losing their jobs if they arrived late for work on Christmas Day. While there were some Christmas Day religious services in New England prior to 1850, 19th century factory owners had their own reasons for treating Christmas as a regular working day, reasons that had more to do with industrial capitalism than Puritan theology. Still, the fact remains that those factory owners were indeed operating within a long New England tradition of opposition to Christmas. As early as 1621, just 1 year after the Puritans landed on Plymouth Rock, their governor, William Bradford, found some of the colony's new residents trying to take the day off. Bradford ordered them right back to work, and in 1659, the Massachusetts General Court did, in fact, declare the observance of Christmas to be a criminal offense. Why? What accounts for this strategy? Of course, one reason was rooted in biblicalism. The Bible gives no indication whatsoever as to what time of year Jesus was born, let alone any specific date. It was only in the 4th century that the church officially decided to observe Christmas on December 25th. And this date was chosen not for religious reasons, but simply because it happened to mark the approximate arrival of the winter solstice, an event that was celebrated long before the advent of Christianity. The Puritans pointed out, and they pointed it out often, that Christmas was nothing but a pagan festival covered with a Christian veneer. The Reverend Increase Mather of Boston, for example, accurately observed in 1687 that the early Christmas December 25th date, not thinking that Christ was born then, but because the heathen Saturnalia was at that time celebrated in Rome, and they were willing to have those pagan holidays metamorphosed into Christian ones. The relationship between Christmas and the ancient Roman Saturnalia was another reason for the Puritan establishment to suppress Christmas. The holiday they suppressed is not what we think of as a traditional Christmas. It involved rowdy public displays of excessive eating and drinking, the mockery of established authority, heaven forbid, aggressive begging, often with the threat of bodily harm, and even the invasion of wealthy homes. There are good historical reasons for this that are related to the celebrations of the Roman Saturnalia. In northern agricultural societies, December was the major punctuation mark in the rhythmic cycle of work, a time when there was a minimum of work to be done. The work of gathering the harvest and preparing it for winter was done, and there was plenty of newly fermented beer and wine, as well as meat from freshly slaughtered animals, meat that had to be consumed before it spoiled. In early modern Europe, the Christmas season was a time to let off steam and to gorge. Excess took many forms. Reveling could eat audience, lubricated by alcohol, making merry lead to trouble. Christmas was a season of misrule, a time when ordinary behavioral restraints could be violated with impunity. It was part of what one historian has called the world of carnival. December was known as the voluptuous month. An Anglican minister, the Reverend Henry Bourne of Newcastle, England, called the way most people commonly behaved during the Christmas season a scandal to religion and an encouraging of wickedness. Bourne, writing in 1725, singled out 2 particularly obnoxious practices, mumming and the singing of Christmas carols. Mumming usually involved a changing of clothes between men and women, who, when dressed in each other's habits and otherwise disguised, went from house to house and made merry with the inhabitants. It thus was the season for much unseemliness and debauchery. As for the singing of Christmas carols, that practice was a disgrace, since it was generally done in the midst of rioting, chambering, and wantonness. Chambering, by the way, was a common euphemism for fornication. The Puritans knew that when the church in the 4th century had placed Christmas Day in late December, that it was a compromise, one in which the church had paid a high price. Late December festivities were deeply rooted in popular culture, both in the observance of the winter solstice and in the celebration of the one briefer and plenty in the agricultural year. In return for ensuring massive observance of the Savior's birth by assigning it to this resonant date, the church tacitly agreed to allow the holiday to be celebrated more or less as it has always been. From the beginning, Christianity's hold over Christmas was and remains tenuous. There were always people for whom Christmas was a time of pious devotion rather than carnival, but such people were always in the minority. It's not going too far to say that Christmas has always been an extremely difficult holiday to Christianize. So, while I cannot recommend it as advisable to break into the house and make merry with them during the holiday season, this was the season for partying and having a boisterous good time long before Christianity attempted to co-opt it for a sacred domestic holiday. Next Monday, on December 26, I will be reporting more on the pagan origins of this season. This report was based on the book The Battle for Christmas by Stephen Nissenbaum. This is Tom Becker for Monday Morning Radio Zine and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The snow is snowing and the wind it is blowing, but I can weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. I cannot remember the worst.
Every second of every minute, every hour of every day, the babblers work at building Babel. Listen to what they say. Reading the news and feeding the views to the minds of a captive nurse. Blending fact and fantasy, the official interpretation. Every night in a billion rooms, a billion minds are fed on a diet of pre-digested fat prepared by talking heads. Oh, bakers, phonies and fakers talking to earn their pay. Gazing out of their plastic world and talking our lives away.
Good morning. This is Norm Diamond, Mole, from... This is the part of the Old Mole, obscure or not so obscure segment of life, and chew a bit on its social roots. Our society shapes everything human, from ideas to actions, from relationships to material products. And these aspects of life would be different if our society were organized differently. It's hard to understand something familiar in this way. What we're used to can seem natural and inevitable. So this part of the Old Mole asks you to step back and see our society with new eyes, as if you were an anthropologist or a visitor from another planet. Today we look back at a horrific event. We try to understand something that would be easier to just cry about. A mass killing. 3 days before Christmas, 8 years ago, in Acteal, Chiapas, Mexico, 60 men armed with heavy caliber weapons invaded a refugee camp for families already driven from their villages. For 4 hours they slaughtered everyone they found, hunting them down in the surrounding hills. After destroying the plastic tarps that were the only shelter. You can tell in my voice I'm crying in the background. Sorry about that. These men systematically mutilated the bodies with machetes. 45 people were killed, of whom 21 were women, and 15 were children. 17 were wounded but managed to hide. 8 of them were children. All of the dead were Tzotzil Indians. The killers were also Tzotzil Indians. At the end of this segment, I'll play you Lila Downs' haunting song, Smoke, commemorating Acteal. For now, I want to ask how we're to understand, whether in Chiapas or Palestinian refugee camps or shelters in former Yugoslavia. Some levels of understanding not only don't illuminate much, they feed our hopelessness, and thus form part of a conservative agenda. To wring our hands over human nature, for instance, doesn't get us very far. We already know of what beastliness we are capable. The question is, under what condition he is brought out. The language of morality doesn't help either. These are clearly acts to be condemned, but it's understanding we're after, and the relationship between understanding and morality at best. The notion of evil, much in vogue in our times, is too simplistic to serve as explanation. Attributing the massacre to long-standing ethnic feuds, just Indians killing Indians, which was the Mexican government's first response, not only pushes a racist stereotype, it also emphasizes that little or nothing can be changed in this world. As an explanation, it is also a lie, as became clear in subsequent months. We soon discovered it was the Mexican army itself that trained and furnished weapons to the so-called paramilitaries who did the massacring. The state government knew of their assault ahead of time. Police set up roadblocks to aid the paramilitaries and keep potential observers away. And local officials were later charged with direct participation in the slaughter. For a genuine understanding, we have to look concretely at the specific social, political, and economic conditions that produced the outcome. 12 years ago, on the first day of 1994, barely after midnight, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, and by taking over San Cristobal de las Casas and military bases in Chiapas. They were brewing, but they deliberately timed it to coincide with the first day of the North American Free Trade Agreement. They did so to call attention to the consequences in their own communities of the economic forces behind NAFTA. The Zapatista Rebellion has been much written about and even romanticized, but it's been little analyzed as a response to globalization and the mobility of capital, or the diminishing will by states to regulate or maintain any social criteria about corporate investments and corporate speculation. This is the level of explanation indispensable for understanding both the Zapatistas and the massacre of their supporters. In Chiapas, those unleashed market forces have meant a loss of land to the Tzotziles and other indigenous people. It's meant their crafts have been undercut. It's meant declining wages when they work on the cattle ranches or coffee plantations. It's meant heavy unemployment and the breakup of families and communities. NAFTA explicitly required an end to Mexican government subsidies of corn, coffee, and cotton, the key crops of the indigenous people of Chiapas. Long ago been forced off their own land to the rocky soils of the mountain slopes by the Spanish conquerors, they are unable to compete with crops produced in the more fertile Mexican valleys or the U.S. heartland or delta. You can still find corn and cotton in the local markets, but now they're imported more from the outside. For the Indians, it's both harder to sell what they produce and harder to obtain currency to buy what they need. As a precondition of NAFTA, the Mexican Congress was required to rewrite the Mexican Constitution. Communally owned land, formerly protected in the Constitution, is individual private property. People are being forced to sell their land and wander far in the search for jobs. These are the forces behind the massacre, as they're some of the forces behind the Mexican migration to the United States. The paramilitaries are a new social grouping, the direct result of NAFTA and international capital. There have been gunslingers before in Chiapas, pistoleros, working for the ranchers and plantation owners, but they were mainly outsiders and in someone's direct employ. The paramilitaries, by contrast, come from within the community. They are indigenous people killing indigenous people, even if that fact is not an explanation. Rather than a salary from a recognizable elite, they collect what they call taxes from their neighbors whom they terrorize. They are young men with no land, unable to find work. They are the ones left behind when their fathers have had to migrate. Having neither land nor jobs, they've not been part of communal work. As the communal farms disintegrate, they're not being socialized into the collective decision-making that's characterized these communities since long before the European invasion. They are a new phenomenon in the Chiapas Highlands, still living in what's left of their family homes, but with few roots in their traditions, banding together to extort and kill, strutting with their Army-issue AK-47s. Their weapons are a clue to another part of the explanation. Whether the paramilitaries know it or not, they're being used. The guns and training they've received are part of the Mexican government's agenda in the area. This is what former Bishop of Chiapas, Samuel Ruiz, meant when he called Acteal, or long announced. Batista uprising to Chiapas in force. Their tactics were to destroy people's crops and tools, to take away the futures of rebellious communities, and make them dependent on the state and market. The paramilitaries continued those tactics with lesser visibility. They enabled the government to pretend an interest in negotiating with the Zapatistas, even while refusing to honor the accords they had already signed. As a result, the government was able to claim it no longer knew with whom to negotiate, that what was happening was simply Indians killing Indians, and that the area needed to be pacified so investment could proceed. The Zapatistas sounded and continued to sound one of the first alarms against globalization. They were followed by the huge French strikes by truckers and public sector workers in 1995, responding to layoffs and cutbacks in public services and pensions, and increased taxes on the poor. Then we had the UPS strike, taking on the issue of temp work, followed by the Seattle protests against the WTO, and the start of a worldwide movement. These have all been resistances to the increased domination by the so-called free market. Understanding the events in far-off Acteal requires awareness of that larger context. Massacre, too, is an aspect of what our government promotes as the New World Economic Order. So much for the understanding. Let's never lose sight of it. This has been Norm Diamond, your mole from another planet, and here is Lila Downs with her take on Acteal. She calls it smoke.
People, how for justice, but will there be goodness when men kill their own? Our wise people say that the mouth of the earth has swallowed her food.
KBOO Portland, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris. I'm here with Tammy Dean this morning, engineering. Thanks to Norm Diamond for that really nice piece about the massacre in Octeal. It's good to remember some of these things that surround our holiday season, some of the more tragic and telling events of our times. Next up, we have part two of Tom Becker's piece on the origins of Christmas, and we'll just have Tom take it away.
Obviously celebrated, if not the most theologically important holiday of the Christian religion, has just passed. I thought it would be interesting to undertake an investigation into the origins and history of the beliefs we associate with this time of the year we call the Christmas season. If the Christian religion, as its practitioners would have us believe, is the religion and was divinely inspired, would it not seem probable that the customs and traditions by which it is celebrated and commemorated would be unique and bear the stamp of this divinity? Would the investigative historian not expect to find these customs and traditions to be singular and unrooted in past tradition? Conversely, if our investigation to reveal the very historicity of Christian traditions, would such discoveries not lend credence to the probable socio-historical origins of Christian practice and belief, a practice and belief in which divine revelation becomes an unnecessary and therefore improbable hypothesis? At any rate, are the speculations that fuel this inquiry? Here are some facts. By the ancient calendar, December 25th marked the winter solstice, the beginning of longer days, the rebirth of the sun, the giver of light and warmth. Most pagan, that is, pre-Christian or non-Christian cultures, commemorated the festival, usually lasting several days or weeks. In Northern Europe, this celebration was called the Yule Festival, and a huge log was burned to help speed the sun in its return. The Mesopotamians performed special rites to assist their god Marduk in his struggle against the powers of chaos and darkness. Greeks offered sacrifices to Zeus to aid him in his battle with Kronos and the Titans. A celebratory mood ensued as the longer days gave proof of his impending victory, culminating in the arrival of spring. Devotees of the Persian god Mithras observed December 25th as the birthday of the invincible sun. The Romans celebrated the feast of the Saturnalia in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture, and it was customary during this time to exchange small gifts, called strena. Another interesting custom of the Roman Saturnalia was the declaration of equality between master and slave. Of course, this equality was symbolic only, expresses a folk recollection of a time when kind began to frame social institutions predicated on the division of society into the classes of the privileged and the underprivileged. The recovery of this lost but symbolically remembered equality finds its echo in the collective striving for peace, tolerance, and human love that remain the ideals, if not necessarily the practice, of this holiday season. All the ancient festivals and celebrations shared in common a spirit, and since it was a time during which common folk had some of their rare leisure between fall harvest and spring planting, a boisterous celebratory mood prevailed. The evergreen has traditionally played an important part in these festivities. For obvious reasons, it has long represented for humankind a symbol of eternal life, an object of veneration and worship. During the solstice rites of the ancient world, the Egyptians erected green date palms indoors. The Romans hung trinkets on pine trees. Druids placed candles, cakes, and gilded apples on tree branches as offerings. The Druids also would gather mistletoe and burn it as a sacrifice. The plant was regarded as a symbol of future hope and peace, and sprigs were hung in their houses. Whenever enemies met under the mistletoe, they would drop their weapons and embrace. It was not until somewhere in the mid-4th century A.D., during the reign of Constantine, that the Church assigned December 25th as a date to celebrate the birth of Jesus. There is no evidence in the Gospels nor any other source that would lend credence to this date over any other as the likely birth date, and was undoubtedly chosen in order to attempt to appropriate for the Christian religion the solstice celebrations of pre-Christian culture. Since that time, the Church has often expressed ambivalent attitudes regarding the very success of that appropriation, as witnessed by Augustine of Hippo's 4th century admonishment, "We hold this day holy, not like the pagans because of the birth of the sun, but because of him who made it." Always disturbed by the tendency of multitudes to cling to the ancient tradition associated with the pagan solstice celebrations, the Puritans went to outlaw Christmas. In 1642, the English Parliament decreed that on the day commonly known as Christmas, no observance shall be had, nor any solemnity used or exercised in churches in respect thereof. Tom Crier shouted, "No Christmas," and the populace was ordered to work as usual. Leave it to those Puritans, the capitalist's best friend, to kill a good party. Throughout this narrative, we discovered that many of the traditions and practices that we have come to think of as exclusively associated with Christianity and Christmas find their antecedents in pre- and non-Christian cultures. We discovered that this time of year is a time of celebration and renewal for people all over the world, and that the association of this time of year with the birth of Jesus is an arbitrary and late tradition. What we have discovered, in fact, is a true people's holiday. So during this season, which pulpits are pounded and Bibles are thumped, calling on us to abandon our wanton ways and to meditate on the solemn nature of this occasion, just recall that the real tradition of this season is much older than the Christian religion, and is a tradition of gaiety, sharing, renewal, and above all, of equality. Oh, yes, and having a boisterous, rowdy good time. Have a merry solstice. This is Tom Becker for Monday Morning Radio Zine and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
It's Christmas time, and I want to see Santa Claus. Yes, it's Christmas time, and I want to see Santa Claus. Gonna ask him for my baby. Ain't that a real good Claus? He was my loving baby, and I love him all.
Well, that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're closing out the show today, and we're closing out the 2005 calendar year. We'll be back again on January 2nd. Thanks again to Bill Resnick and Steve Downs calling us from New York City to talk about the transit strike and workers' attempts to democratize unions and cultures, societies, and people. We will be back again, as I said. Tammy Dean has been our engineer for today, and we'll suspect she'll be back with us again in 2006. I'll be back. We'll all be back. Have a great morning. Thanks.